There's more than one recording of Nina Simone singing Mississippi Goddamn. There's two in particular that I like, one in 1964 and one in 1968. The song came out in 1964. I think she's performing it at Carnegie Hall. And she has such pep and such energy. And if you've never heard the song, you must be white. And you must be white. But she's performing with such pep and such energy because it's clever. And she's in 1964 and she doesn't know that 65, 66, 67, and 68 are coming, right?
Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi. Goddamn.
Hi, I'm Eric.
And I am Brittany.
And we are For Color Nerds.
Yes, conversations that black people have when white people are not in the room.
Yes, yes. Today, we're going to be talking about...
Nina Simone. As you probably have already been able to surmise.
I actually just recently saw, you had seen it before, but the Netflix documentary, What Happened, Miss Simone?
Yes.
Excellent documentary.
Oh, God, if you haven't seen it, I would see it immediately. I mean, immediately after listening to the show. I'd be like, finish this first, but then go watch What Happened, Miss Simone.
But no, it was an excellent documentary. Really did as deep as you can go in 2 hours, did a pretty deep dive into her life, her struggles, and yeah, I mean, I definitely learned a lot. And it was also interesting to put, like, we actually also read this article.
Yes.
The Many Battles of Nina Simone.
Yes, it was from The New Yorker, I think, last year. Yeah. Well, it'll be in the notes. It'll be obvi.
You'll know. Mm-hmm. You'll read it. But it's always interesting seeing these things in context. Like, you know, with the archival footage, like with a lot of the other clips that they pulled together, the interviews, like hearing and seeing something, I think just allows your mind to really like process the depth of things.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
It connects all the dots for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas reading it, like while it's still interesting, it can still affect you. Sometimes there's a distance there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that I think the documentary did an amazing job of building on. No, but we both wanted to talk about Nina Simone. I mean, we've talked about her before in the show.
Mm-hmm. We have talked about her before in the show.
And I think her impact is something that, you know, her legacy is something that really can't be matched, and it hasn't really been...
No.
Like,
no, it hasn't. I can't think of a single person.
And that's interesting because even like during her time, she was like, she's always just been this unique like figure, you know, like no one was really singing how she sang.
No.
Even her subject matter was amazingly, you know, unique and like distinctive. You know, almost to her detriment.
Yeah.
Or well, I mean, almost.
Yeah, almost definitely to her detriment in a lot of ways. But also, too, like, when you talk about her being unmatched, now the whole talk about, you know, reopening the conversation about protest music, because we're obviously in a, not even just protest music, but music of resistance and music of struggle. We're at a point where we need it again. And we have had some, you know, some one-offs, but there hasn't been one person who has been super talented, but also wildly popular and super well known, who is also consistently recording and speaking out about these issues and, you know, giving it straight to the people. So, yeah, it's interesting that, you know, in many other ways and in many other, I guess, touch points of the movement or whatever, you can draw clear comparisons between certain people. Mm-hmm. You know, Nina Simone is coming back up now because there's nobody who you can... You know what I mean? There's nobody kind of taking up that mantle.
Yeah, she's really unparalleled. Like, it's crazy to the degree, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, honestly, I was thinking back, like, she's been such a consistent presence, like, in my life. Like, I mean, obviously, we're both big music nerds.
Yeah.
You know, and I've always been really interested in jazz. And that's actually, I came to her music through her jazz music. The first CD I ever got from my sister was a hand-me-down from my sister because she didn't really want it. but it was Jazz Masters. It was, you know, Verve. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah, I remember.
The Verve Jazz Masters series, like volume 20, I think. And it had Love Me or Leave Me on it.
She has such a good version of that.
And it's like, this is just like really like amazingly, like, brisk, like, it's just peppy. Mm-hmm. You know, she's just moving through, bouncing over all these notes. And then it has this, like, ridiculously long, like, piano solo.
Uh-huh.
And her talent across the board when mm-hmm. it comes to jazz was, like, really, really insane.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no matter your mood, you can come to a Nina Simone track and, like, there's a perfect track for that.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
like you're happy, you're yeah. sad, melancholy,
in love, heartbroken.
Yeah. Turned up.
Turned up.
Angry.
Yeah.
Ready, know,
ready
pissed
to go.
Off.
Yeah.
But there is something there for you. And she has something there for you. And it's
yeah.
always extremely comforting, no matter what it is. It's just interesting to think back to that. Like, she really has always been a presence. And I never really took the time to dive deeper than the music.
Yeah. No, actually, same. I, you know, she was around when I was growing up, but she wasn't, if I'm perfectly honest, we were a super deep Motown home when
yeah.
I was growing up. But so she was around, her music was present. I definitely had access to it. We listened to it. But I really got into Nina Simone when I was, you know, when I really started going to Howard, and at every single, because, you know, when you first start going to black college, there's like yeah. a talent show every 6 hours. It's, I mean, have my fucking life. And every single talent show would be, you know, four girls from the quad, Annex would never deign themselves to do this. But four girls from the quad, maybe Cook Hall, who had gotten themselves together to put on some, you know, unitards and dance to four women.
Interesting enough, I don't know if it was my freshman year or maybe it was when you were there,
uh-huh.
but in the fashion show, the intro was to four women.
I don't remember. I'm going to be honest with you.
The homecoming fashion.
I was going to be honest with you. I've, like, never been to.
You never went to the fashion show?
I've never been to, like, any homecoming event. I've been to, like, some.
Wow.
I haven't been homecoming since, honestly, the year after you graduated. So 2008.
Damn.
I went to homecoming.
That's deep. Huh?
And this shit was expensive. So
it was
just, you know what I'm saying?
And folks was real thirsty for the tickets.
Right. So you have to get up in the morning. First of all, I wasn't going to fucking class. So I wasn't about to get up and go spend some money to go to some event with the same black folks I was sitting with the rest of the time. Like, I wasn't
thirsty. Better clothes.
But in better clothes, exactly. So the four women was always, like, omnipresent. But what really struck me about her when I was that age was reading a little bit into, like, the philosophy behind the way that she thought about herself as an artist, where she talked about, like, my music is not jazz music. My music mm-hmm. is black classical music.
Yeah.
And I was just like, shit. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I was already in this really impressionable position, having just left Mayberry. And then, yeah, right, moved to Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
10 years ago and, you know, attending this black school. And, you know, I was reaching a new and higher level of consciousness. But I was also, you know, I was a kid, so it was like a confusing time. But to have this black woman, obviously black woman,
yeah.
who, you know, I was really starting to understand her legacy and just how popular she was back in the day, to be like, I don't make jazz music, I make black classical music. I was like, well, goddamn. That is yeah. the correct way to think about it.
It really is.
Yeah, like the way that she was so self-possessed really affected me at that specific age and the way that I thought about myself and the way that I felt that I was allowed to think about myself. So that a lot of my connection to Nina Simone is like, she just had this, I don't even want to call it defiant attitude because that, I think that gives too much credit to whoever is trying to hold her back. But she just was super, like,
she was
this
very
is who
real.
I am. Yeah, she was fucking real as hell.
She was
hell.
Very human in the sense of, like, she was extremely confident, but she also, she wasn't afraid to express vulnerability. Like,
mm-hmm.
you know, there were times she was like, I'm tired. Like,
yeah.
I'm tired. Like, I'm exhausted. I'm borderline depressed. Like,
yeah.
you know, she was just like, she was what she was, and she was not afraid to tell you what she was.
Yeah.
At any given moment.
That was one of the coolest parts of the documentary was
yeah.
that, you know, that her husband, her ex-husband, I think he ended up being, had given
yeah.
The...
She divorced him.
Yeah, she divorced him. We're going to get into that. but had given the whoever it was that worked on it access to, I think, or maybe it wasn't the people who worked on the documentary, but he gave somebody, the public, let's say, access to her, you know, private diaries and letters.
Mm.
And seeing the way that she thought about, the way that she expressed herself written was so human. And it was
yeah.
so regular.
It was also pretty bare.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah.
She just, I mean, it was very, it makes sense. Obviously, those were her, like, mostly her journals.
Yeah.
But she just was very open about despair.
Yeah.
Which was deep to, like, really read that. Like, you know, I think she talked one time about a conversation that she had. She didn't really know how to come back to. She had talked to, I think, Andrew Stroud is her.
Yeah, is her husband's name. Yeah.
She had talked to, she called him Andy. They talked about her committing suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, oh, well, you know, if you did, you know, I would be okay.
Yeah. 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 And it's like, to have that, like, to have that, to see her, like, we talk about despair, to see her as this person who is this public figure who's so, like, still very human, like you said, but also very, like, she seems so strong and she seems, like, indestructible in a lot of ways. To then have this whole, not just, like, private life that people experienced or, like, this inner life that we're guessing at, but to see her fully aware of all of her emotions and then, like, fully aware of, like, their documentation is really interesting.
Like, if you think about her music, mm-hmm. even, and this speaks to the degree of her genius.
Yeah.
She had to be able to, and she was able to tap into so many different facets and nuances of emotion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's, like, for the amazing thing about her is that wasn't just musically. Like, she really got it. She got how she was feeling at every particular moment, which was how she was able to put that into her song. And she just also happened to translate that into her journals in the way she talked about herself. And that was, like you said, that was really, really interesting to see someone be that in tune with themselves and how they were feeling.
She knew how she was feeling all of the time, even if she was going the fuck through it.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? She knew how she was feeling all of the time. It's like she never, you know, for all of the talk, and, you know, we're obviously going to get into this, but all the talk about her being temperamental, you know, she never, when you think about someone being temperamental, you think about them being severely out of touch at a lot of points. She never fully lost touch with where she was. Even if she was in the eye of the storm, she never really fully lost touch with, like, her reality, if that makes any sense. Like, she was fully, she was, like, and on some level, she was always fully present.
Yeah.
And that was something that carried into every area of her, like, creative life, which was very, very cool.
It's clear that that kind of started at an early age.
Mm.
Her genius and her aptitude at piano, you know, or at music, rather, was discovered at a very early age and seen as something that kind of needs to be cultivated, right? So I think she always recognized that, like, she was who she was, but she also had this thing.
Yeah.
You know, and she was kind of beholden to see where this thing goes.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, she obviously wanted that in the beginning.
Yeah.
But towards the middle.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously the end, you know, she very much realized that her existence and, like, her happiness, you know, was, like, tied almost to an uncomfortable degree to this talent.
Yeah.
And I think that gets at what you were saying, like, her being cognizant of her reality.
Because,
you know, even, you know, they say she was, like you said, they say she was temperamental, or sometimes people describe it as, like, talking to two different people, or she would just flip, you know, if things weren't right. But I think that also speaks to the fact that, you know, she knew what she had to do.
Yeah.
To be able to produce what she needed.
Yeah. I mean, shit. You know that before we even record this little shit right here, we have to sit down and we have to talk about things, just whatever, for a little while, and then, you know, sit down and then do the show.
Yeah.
So, like, I can only imagine if you're producing regularly, you know, not just for your life's work, but also for just, like, you know, thousands, millions of people around the world who, like, use your music to subsist. And you're making not just things that are of super high quality, but also that are so, like you say, expressive and also so so necessary and so, like, in tune with what's happening in the world. If you're creating something at that level and at that volume and for that, like, large of a mass audience, like, you have to, I can only imagine the things that you feel that you need to do to be able to be in the space to create on a regular basis.
Yeah. And with such, like you said, like, with such a, like, internal mandate.
Yeah.
You know
yeah,
what I'm saying? Like, yeah. she really, like, especially towards, you know, once she kind of began making protest music, where even, I think, to a degree before, actually from the beginning, because she wanted to be, like, you know, she had these aspirations to be the first Black classical pianist.
Yeah.
That's not a small goal.
No, especially not for some little black girl from the South in, like, you know, the early 1900s.
Yeah, like, you know, that's a huge mandate. Like, that's a huge thing to say that, like, not only is this what I want, this is what I
feel compelled to do.
Yeah, and this is what I refuse to not attain. Mm. You know, and obviously her goal changed, you know, as her circumstances changed, but she still, like, it didn't necessarily get any less lofty.
No. No.
So, yeah. So you have these, like, this complex set of things, this talent that you have to tap into that isn't scientific.
Yeah.
You know, you need some specific shit to do it.
You really do need some specific shit to do it. You do.
And, you know, and it's difficult, I imagine, to work with other people and to have to, like, you're taking this thing out of yourself and you're trying to give it to other people to then turn into something.
Yeah.
And that's not always an easy process. You know, like, she was very in tune with herself and translating her own thoughts and emotions, but giving that to someone else to play, I imagine it doesn't always come out right because there's just things that are lost in translation.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So, I mean, it makes a lot of sense considering the degree of her, like, genius, mm-hmm. you know. Shit would be a little complicated.
Yeah. Well, you know what's interesting is actually the same week that I happened to watch this the first time. The same week that I saw it, I also happened, because you know I don't go to the movies, so I don't know how my black ass ended up in the theater. But I saw the Amy Winehouse documentary. Mm. And we talk about, like, you know, being temperamental or whatever, or needing certain things to create. It was very interesting to watch those two things in the same week. I didn't realize Amy Winehouse. If you haven't seen it, I would say go see it. It's pretty good. But I didn't realize that she was as talented as she is. And I would not put her at, like, Nina Simone level, but she was definitely prodigious.
Yeah.
And she was more talented than most people that I see make anything.
Yeah.
And it was interesting, like, when you talk about, like, the compulsion to make something at a certain level and to reach, you know, to communicate a specific thing, it was like, it's almost like you have this, it's almost like a beast that you have inside of you that you have, it's like you have to feed it, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, depending on what you feed it and how you feed it, the output can always be good, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, Amy Winehouse is able to put out a lot of brilliant music at a very young age. And you know, same with Nina Simone, you know, the outcome will be good, but what happens to you, you know what I'm saying? It's kind of like this, so much of it felt out of control for both of them, but it's even seems, I can see how you feel like you have to, are subsumed by this thing.
Yeah, it clearly, like, warped her.
Yeah.
There was a point in the documentary where her daughter, I think Lisa.
Yeah.
Her daughter was communicating the fact that after Mississippi Goddamn, after she wrote and performed it for the first time, mm-hmm. she said her voice broke.
Yeah.
I don't doubt
No.
that she knows, you know, the difference in the, like, the abilities of her own voice. And she said the only thing that kind of subsisted her was, again, this, like, this idea that I'm doing what I have to do. She said, I think something like the movement carried me through. But to recognize that, like, the weight of all of these things is changing me physically.
Yeah.
That's heavy.
Yeah, and you actually make a really good point, because it's not even just like with Amy Winehouse, she had, like, it was just the sheer talent and the sheer need to make something. But also, like, Nina had this extra thing. Obviously, she's a black woman, which is its own set of shit.
Yeah.
But additionally, that time, like, something I read some article. I have to go back and find it. If I find it, I'll put it in the notes. I don't remember where it was, but I'll find it. But it was about how the movement, like, killed people back then. You know what I'm saying? Not just like, and, you know, bang, bang, you're dead. Yeah. We're white. We shot you. But, like, it broke. Like, you know, you see the way that being compelled to serve at that level, there was not an emphasis back then on taking care of yourself. Also, because you didn't know. You know what I'm saying? We were just talking about before we recorded. When you signed up for the movement, you don't realize this shit gonna be.
It don't stop.
It don't ever stop. It's a lot of times it just doesn't even ever feel like it gets better. But yeah, you don't realize that you signed up for a lifelong jig. And, like, even just participating artistically at that level, at that time, like, that shit, obviously a lot of shit was going to break up her family anyway.
Yeah.
But, I mean, but, like, that's that, you know, people's families couldn't stay together. They talk about that.
Yeah.
They talk about that in the documentary. You can't, it wasn't just you. It takes you. It takes your children. It takes your spouses. It takes your partners. It, like, you say it warps your life.
Yeah.
So to have not just the talent, But to also have, like I said, being called to serve at that level, like, it's a miracle that she says she honestly.
That she came out through it.
Yeah, and lived as long as she did.
In general, she really struggled with self-care.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That was something that was really clear.
That is the understatement of the week.
Yes. Yeah. Like, she discussed, like, the running theme pretty early on till the end was how tired she was.
Yeah.
And, you know, before she even got to the weight of the movement,
mm-hmm.
Civil rights movement, she discussed just being tired from the pace. Like, it was clear that her husband saw something, what he wanted her to be,
yeah,
what he thought she could be, and refused to allow anything less than that. And at the time, you know, she was so in love with him,
mm-hmm.
and I imagine also in love with her career and what she was producing,
yeah,
that she didn't feel empowered to be able to stop and say, hey,
yeah,
I just need to, you know, I just need some time. I just need to take some me time. And it's clear that manifested itself in several extremely harmful ways later on in her life.
Mm-hmm.
Having been able to take a break, who knows what she was capable of.
Yeah.
You know, like, and the crazy thing, it's not like she didn't accomplish a shit ton.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, her abilities, like her essence and her creative peak might have gone.
Yeah.
So much further.
Yeah, like and without destroying her.
Yeah. With, you know, self-care. And it's interesting in context to the people around her. Her, you know, her colleagues in terms of musicians and, like, the other people she knew.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I think with stories like this, and there are many, this type of narrative isn't brand new. People don't talk about how complicit those people around are. In not saying, hey,
sit your black ass down.
Yeah, you need something.
Yeah.
You know, you need some help in some sort of way. That's something that's interesting. It's disappointing to not see people kind of take or even express some sort of regret at not being more proactive to like step in and help. Like, you know, these are her friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's obviously it's probably complicated because you're making money,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
based off of your friend's output.
Yeah.
But, you know, at what point do you say, like, oh, this person, like, really needs me?
Yeah. But then also you wonder, like, you know, were any of these people taking care of themselves? Do you know what I'm saying?
Good point.
Yeah. Like, when also, like, not just, like, the people who are directly around her, but, like, her contemporaries and stuff like that. Like, what's my girl? Well, you know, Lorraine Hansberry, I wish I could remember the exact quote, but it's something to the tune of, like, you know, what makes you, if anything, you know, what makes you special, if anything at all, must also make you very lonely. Mm. And she kind of struggled with a lot of the same types of things. I think that she was around a lot of people who were, I mean, if you really think about how young a lot of these people were, this is, you know what I mean?
Lorraine Hansberry was like 29, 28.
Yeah, exactly. When she popped off, I mean.
And that was a huge, like, Raising the Sun been big for a while. Like, that was a massive.
This wasn't like a club single.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, we say popped off, like, yeah. Like, I mean, especially to be not just a young person, but, like, a young black woman in the 50s fucking doing the goddamn thing.
Yeah.
Like, that's, you know, and, you know, you think about James Baldwin, Langston Hughes. Even, I wonder, too, like, I think that maybe they were, like, the first. I hate this term because I think it's so bougie and weird, but creative class. I think that, like, you know, they're one of the earliest black creative classes to actually have some of the tools and some of the wealth and some of the notoriety mm-hmm. that might allow them to be able to take care of themselves.
Yeah.
But if you think about when they grew up, these people grew up in late, I mean, some cases late 1800s, early 1900s, you know, 1910s, 20s, 30s. And you think about the emotional and, like, sometimes physical and just real life trauma that comes with, you know, growing up black, they probably didn't, you know, you probably don't even have the tools. Do you know what I'm saying? You don't have, you're like, I'm not getting shot at. So, like, you know what I'm saying?
Upgrade.
I'm not, yeah, upgrade. Exactly. Like, I'm not worried about lynch mob, you know, on Tuesday night.
Yeah.
Like, that's, you know, it's like when you talk about Maslow's hierarchy of needs,
mm-hmm.
I know I always mispronounce that word. I don't care. But we talk about that, like, you know, you can't even get to the point where you're going to take care of yourself because you're just happy that you can secure your physical space.
Yeah.
And you can secure your person and pay for yourself and pay for the people around you.
No, that's a great point. And I imagine you also probably felt a high degree of responsibility not to stop.
Yeah. Because, you know? Yeah, yeah.
What other black people were doing? You
know exactly.
What I'm saying? Like there were very few times where a black person, the only thing that would necessarily stop them would be them.
Yeah.
You know, so to be in that position and then choose to say, I'm going to take a step back.
Yeah.
You don't know if that's it.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's a great point.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, I didn't consider it.
I mean, it's just, you know, it just came to me now. But yeah, no, that sort of, like you can't even think to taking care of yourself doesn't even seem like an option if maybe it doesn't even seem like an option. You feel like, like I said, you just feel like I'm safe and the people around me are safe and I can do the things that I want to do with my time and my money. I'm good.
Yeah.
You know?
It was just, it's really difficult to think back to that and see an existence in its entirety and like how that's hard. You know,
yeah.
That it was hard for her for a long time.
Yeah, I was going to say pretty much the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's just tough. But, and it's clear, it, you know, eventually led to her really, or, you know, it's actually no telling how long she was struggling with. But, you know, eventually these things manifested themselves into bipolar disorder. She was announced as being manic, which, in, you know, at the end, they don't actually communicate this.
It's like two-thirds of the way through
the movie. Yeah, two-thirds of the way through the movie. You know, I knew of it because, obviously, I read this article, you know, around the time, and recently I've done a little more research.
Mm-hmm.
But that puts so many things into context. That puts so many of her struggles into context.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it makes me think back to like self-care. And now, like, mm-hmm. you know, now I think it's important that we take stories like this and, you know, the takeaway being I have to take care of myself. Because these things can manifest themselves
mm-hmm.
in pretty difficult ways from a mental health perspective. Like, we have to push each other to take care of ourselves.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, that's just really, really important, regardless of aptitude.
Yes, regardless of aptitude, regardless of what you feel your responsibility is.
Yeah. I don't know. I just feel like that needed to be said.
No, I mean, no. I 100% agree, especially now. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, actually, there's surprisingly frequent conversations of black female genius.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
If you think about Beyonce, actually, probably more so like Serena.
Yes. Like, yes.
Obviously, I don't know Serena's situation. But, you know, they talk about, you know, she's talked about the difficulty of being who she is.
Yeah.
And that constant attack. But I just think it's interesting in talking about, like, aptitude, recognizing aptitude.
Yeah, recognizing greatness in black women.
Yeah, and like, you know, how much people want to push.
Yeah.
And, you know, in light of that, I think it's important that we also say, like, hey, you also gotta, like, you're a person, you're a human being.
Yeah.
You gotta take care of yourself.
Well, you talked about Lauryn Hill. I'm looking at the notes, and you mentioned Lauryn Hill. You know, Afropunk was it last weekend? Yeah,
because
that's when I got the flu. But I didn't go on Saturday when she performed because I'm gonna be honest. Because it's hard for me to want to see her now,
mm-hmm.
just because I don't even have the words. It's like you love somebody's work so much, but you also know that like like you said about Serena, I don't know Lauryn Hill's situation, but there's a possibility that this person is less of who they were mm-hmm. possibly meant to be because they gave you this thing and because people keep requesting that she do this thing that she was doing 18 years ago. And it's like, it's hard for me to sit there and watch it because I know that I'm going to be disappointed. And she doesn't seem really okay.
She seems like she's definitely like struggling with something.
Yeah. Because I mean, at first I think everybody thought like, okay, Lauren going through something. Because she was young. When that shit's
real young.
I didn't realize how young. She was like 23, 24.
Yeah.
You know, and not just to be creating all this stuff, but to becoming a mother for the first time, which is something she did over and over and over and over and over again. But, like, to be almost similar to Nina.
Yeah.
To be this dark skinned black woman in America and go from being, you know, one of the Fugees, as Nina Simone was, but to go from being one of the Fugees to then being like, you know, she was considered for a role in Charlie's Angels movie, to becoming like America's sweetheart in a way. Do you know what I'm saying? Or America's like one of America's most treasured talents, which is a difficult, like a spot that that often goes to black women in many ways, but begrudgingly so. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So to go from to being one of the Fugees and being basically like a late teen, and then to becoming like one of America's most treasured talents, where all of a sudden, like, it was kind of like, fuck you, to like, oh, you made us this one thing. You're okay now.
Yeah.
It's obvious not only that was it super popular, but it was obvious that she was a genius. And, you know, and it was critically acclaimed at every level. And it was, you know, like, so well loved that people still, you know, you can play any song from that album. The shit still sounds like the shit came out yesterday. And, to be processing that and to be so young, like, I'm sure that would break anybody.
Yeah. And actually, I mean, it reminds me of it. I read a tweet. It basically said, like, Lauryn Hill almost broke herself by giving us this perfect thing.
Yeah.
You know, she made this perfect album.
Yeah.
And it literally, you know, it did break her.
Yeah. And I think by, like, 2000, 2001, 2002, maybe, I think we all thought, okay, well, Lauryn's going through a thing. She's probably almost 30.
She's coming back.
Yeah. You know, right. But now it's like, okay, no, this is who she's been now for the better part of her adult life and for being in the public eye. And it is not for nothing, you know what I'm saying, that she made this album. And, like, ever since then, it's like, the shit ain't been all the way back.
And even the type of music that she makes now, like, Not, I don't want to say that she can't, but she won't go back to producing a style of music.
Yeah.
You know, that.
Yeah, that is easily digestible for other people. I don't think that's what she set out to do. I think she just was making what she wanted to make. It turned out that it was this thing that everybody loved. And it's like almost like she's resistant, like you say, to do something like that again. It's almost like it's like you could look at it a couple ways. Like, in one way, she could be stifling herself to keep. She could be stifling herself to keep from, like, becoming that popular again, or to keep maybe she feels like we don't deserve it. I don't know. But she also could be like, you know, not just almost being selfish, which in her case, I don't think that's a bad thing. I think it's fine.
Yeah, because she's a human. She's a person.
Her
responsibility is first and foremost to herself.
To herself. Exactly. So I don't think that that's crazy. But, like, I don't know. Yeah. You know?
All right. So I think we need to come back to her relationship with
her
husband.
This motherfucker.
Yeah. It was, like, I think I mentioned this to you before. It was shocking how...
cavalier?
Yeah. He was ridiculously open,
chill,
and like calm, cool about his like clear and ridiculously violent, you know, and an extreme abuse.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he was like, I'm sure like they detailed several accounts in the documentary that were referenced in her personal diaries. I'm sure those were not the only instances.
Oh, no.
And those were only the ones that made the page of her diary. Do you know what I'm saying? So, like, he was unrepentant in beating her ass on a regular basis to a fucking pulp.
And in front of their kid.
Yeah.
Like, in front of their child. Like, that was chilling.
Yeah.
Like, I remember I was watching with Carla, and, like, we just both looked at each other like, it made you feel extremely uncomfortable to hear someone talk in that manner about that, like, with no clear remorse.
Yeah. But I mean, like, it's an abuser. That's an abuser thing.
Yeah.
But also, like, that's seeing the way that that kind of played out. Like, the abuse in that relationship played out in her life, but then also within their family dynamic.
Yeah.
Seeing Lisa, their daughter, talk about how abusive her mother was and how she could, you know, she's like, and I can, it put you in such a crazy position, as I'm sure abuse does in real life, where you see that this person, Andrew Stroud, was like the source of everybody's fucking, he was the linchpin, right? And so he's beating Nina, and basically almost killing her all of the time. And she, you know, because the way like abuse cycles, manifests itself, yeah, in cycles, it's like, you know, she was abusing their daughter, but then he's not abusing their daughter. So she he became for Lisa a safer bet as far as the parent to spend most of her time with. It was just like, fuck. And you kind of also see her. I'm sure I can't imagine the mental gymnastics that she has to go through to compartmentalize. She seemed very okay. And she's a performer herself. She's been on Broadway a few different times, and she's made music and done a few different things. But just to be like this person who's very okay, like a very okay full adult, who can process the fact that her mother was this, like, you know, just like had possessed uncontrollable genius and was such a huge and awesome and great person in so many ways, but also was her, you know, her abuser. And then also was, you know, this person who's taking care of her in the day-to-day sense is the person who's killing her mother and probably helping to turn her mother into the monster that she experienced. Was like,
ooh.
Yeah, that was some shit.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like you said, I think it was amazing that how okay, you know, she seemed to be. I can't imagine, like, the power dynamic. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, Nina Simone's talked a lot about desiring freedom, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, obviously, you know, she eventually was able to leave her husband. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she went to Liberia. And so I can't imagine, having come through all of that. And then you get away, you know, the rush. Like, the rush of, like, you know, being away, being free. She talked about, I only wore bikinis and boots.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, but then also probably the rush of anger. Because now you have a chance to truly
process
and sit on everything that's happened to you. That's got to be extremely difficult. And I imagine that also warped her to a certain degree in terms of, you know. And then your daughter comes here who's, you know, even though this is your child, it's also a product of this person.
Yeah.
You know, who was your abuser and your attacker for so long. That's not a justification, but I get the cycle.
It makes sense.
It's not a far leap.
No. To see not that, a far leap to see that that,
that
was something
that would
was,
happen.
No.
But coming back to this dude.
This motherfucker.
And it's the thing that you brought up that was a great point is that it's a common trope.
You know, oh, yes.
To have.
Oh, you were talking earlier. Yes.
Yeah.
I was like, people are going to be like, when did you say that?
Right, exactly. Let me rewind. But no, Brittany was pointing out, you know, and I'll let her elaborate, but this trope of kind of a man being, I guess, a shepherd, if you will, of female genius.
That's something that even came up in the something that repeatedly came up in even the Amy Winehouse documentary.
Yeah,
where like most of the conversations that were had about her talent happened with her father, her ex-boyfriends, her producer, her manager. Like there were all of these people that were kind of like pulling the strings, especially which is weird because you see especially in her early career before she just like alcoholism just consumed her.
Yeah.
You see that she was very much like the captain of her own ship. Like she knew what she wanted. She was very driven. She was very on it. So then to kind of see once, you know, once people start to get them dollar signs, you know what I'm saying, in their eyes. Then to sort of see every single man in her life be like, and a couple of them had true intentions. I would say there were maybe two. There was two that they were discussed a lot in, or maybe three that were discussed a lot in the actual movie. So it was like DJ Salaam Remy and like, well, I think Amy Winehouse's manager and like this other guy. But like everybody else was like, I got to get my motherfucking check. I need, because it's like, I either got to go on vacation, I got to pay for my house, I got to buy my drugs. Nina Simone had obviously, you know, with Andrew Stroud, a very similar thing where, like, this motherfucker was a cop, okay? He was a cop.
Like sergeant, detective, I think.
Yeah. And which is, again, no small feat for a black man back then. So for him to be a cop and be like, you know what, I'm going to leave my position to manage you. And like you said earlier, everything he said he was going to do, he did it. Like, yeah. They were up in Mount Vernon with staff.
Yeah.
Right? When we were both sitting there, like, during the documentary when Lisa was talking about, no staff. I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
Y'all was really doing it.
Yeah. To even be able to refer, not like, oh, you know, everybody left plus our nanny.
Yeah, no.
Staff. That's a plural.
Yes, that's multiple people. So many people, you can't even name them all in one sentence, right? They're all working for y'all on the payroll, taking care of you and your shit in your house. So, like, the fact that, like, within a few years of being with Andrew, like, that was the shit that Nina had. Like, you know, it's like even in Dreamgirls. Do you know what I'm saying?
It's a lot. Dreamgirls?
Yep.
Can we say, hell, Serena? Beyonce?
Yeah.
Bessie?
Yeah. Yep.
Janet?
Yep.
Like.
Yep. And even like I said, I mentioned earlier in the TLC movie, I don't really know if Left Eye really had a controlling boyfriend that was trying to get. We don't know for sure if that was actual fact or just, you know, just as fake as the wig they put on that woman who played Pebbles. We don't know. But we do know that the fact that like that trope is common enough that like it was an easy plug into the script. Do you know what I'm saying? To be able to patch up any holes to be like, all right, so what do we need to do to show that Left Eye is about to kind of like go all the way left?
Yeah.
Like, oh, we're going to throw in a boyfriend named Larry. You know what I'm saying? Like, that is, it's that common of a trope.
And the interesting thing, I was trying to figure out how, like.
Shit, Diana Ross. I just thought about that, but yeah.
Yeah, like how I felt about this. And it's interesting how, you know, also if you think about the way we talked in the From Bessie to Beyonce episode about how people often associate more of the genius and the success to the men in these situations, you know, and they doubt the true like talent and I think capabilities of, you know, the women who have the, you know, the talent and I guess in their eyes, the product.
Yeah.
But there's little attention paid to how predatory that is.
Yep.
Like, you know, like it's clear that these men in certain situations, and mind you, you know, they obviously have, in a lot of cases, have been there from an early age, but it's still predatory to say, you know, I see this thing and this person who I'm connected to.
Mm-hmm.
Let me drive them into the ground to get it out of them, to get something, you know, under this umbrella of, or this banner of, I'm trying to make you the best that I can be.
That's
those weren't the words said in the documentary or, you know, in things we've read about, like, all of the women we just named.
Yeah.
But that's a lot of how they try to hint. Like, you think about Joe, like, you know, he was like, oh, I'm whipping y'all to get y'all in shape, you know, in terms of, like, the Jackson 5 with Michael and all them.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, they're clearly more selfish intentions.
Yes.
Around.
You know, you think even just about, just take Joe out for a second. This motherfucker.
Ike.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, Ike, if you will. Shit. But yeah, this motherfucker, Joe Jackson, still can afford fucking at 87 Viagra and hoes. Do you know what I'm saying? To be able to even have all them strokes he was just having. Like, because he's living off his kids that fucking serious.
It's like, it's crazy that there isn't more attention paid to that.
Yeah.
You know, to the predatory nature of that. Like,
yeah.
And also, you know, that being a clear marker of abuse. Now, obviously, I don't know what happened with, you know, like Beyonce and like Serena.
Yeah, each of
these situations. But, it's a clear trend in a lot of those cases that there was abuse happening. Obviously, we you know, saw it. He copped to it directly.
Yeah, chilling. Yeah.
In this documentary, everybody, you know, like that was understood. It is abuse in some sense.
Yeah, well, even when we talk about Beyonce, there's a, like, you know, she don't seem like she even speak to her daddy. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, to be, that's part of the reason why I find her story, so interesting, is that, like, yeah, there's that whole, obviously her father recognized that she was talented very young and got her and her friends or whatever on a program very young. But to see her reach a certain age and kind of cut that tie and be running her own career is very interesting to me. But yeah, there's obviously something, you know, I read the issue of Ebony with Tina on the cover. Like, regardless of, I don't know anything about, you know, abuse physically with Matthew Knowles, and I don't want to put any words in anybody's mouth, but he was a clear emotional abuser.
Mm-hmm.
And I could definitely see how that is something that also, you know, like,
played
into the mix.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
There's many different types.
Yes.
You know, of ways that abuse can manifest itself.
Yeah.
And that's just deep. Like, that's deep to think back, you know, so consistently about that. And that's still, like, a running theme. And the questions that we still ask ourselves are, you know, well, Beyonce needs somebody. You know, well, this person needs somebody.
Yeah.
Like, because they don't have it themselves. And we're not asking ourselves those same questions.
Yeah.
Of the men in these scenarios.
Nope. But when you talk about the abusive relationship, I had mentioned before when I was, like, I think in a different episode, the sex ed episode, we talked about cycles of abuse, and I learned when I was volunteering that, like, it took me years after I was in a relationship and I was much younger, where somebody used to say the craziest shit to me. I didn't realize it was verbal abuse until I was, like, 25. And then all of a sudden I was like, oh, it's not normal for somebody to tell you that. Like, no one's ever going to love you. Like, that's not normal. But, like, that, when you know, obviously, I had a very different experience than Nina Simone.
Yeah.
But I can only imagine, like, what it does to your brain to realize that you were in a space where all of this crazy shit was okay.
Yeah.
It's like, I can't even describe to you what it's like to realize all of a sudden that you don't have to do that.
Yeah.
Or that you didn't even really know that you were there. And then you also wonder, like, well, am I still there now? Like, what's happening? You know what I mean? It's like, I can only imagine when you talk about her going to Liberia, what it did to be away from him and to like you say, sit and not just process and be angry, but just also to be like, not just angry at him, but also be like, how the fuck did I get here? And yeah. While I was like, yeah, it's great that I have, you know, I can travel and I can sell out, you know, tours, and I can, you know, sell all these albums and people love my music. But like, how the fuck did I lose my own shit in this whole, and like, what is, like,
to who, such a degree.
Right. And who even am I? Because I can only imagine after decades of all of that. I can
and that being
only
so
imagine.
Closely tied to your success.
Exactly. Exactly. To know that you wouldn't have your daughter or this house in Mount Vernon or the staff or any of that organization or that initial push that you needed to get your career through, to be able to know that all of that is, a lot of that may have been impossible without this person who killed you, basically. Yeah. Like, I don't even know. I don't even know what that, the fact that she was actually even still able to, like, perform and, like, produce stuff after that blows my mind completely. It's that, and that also just even speaks to, you know, it speaks to the nature of genius in and of itself, that it can survive.
Yeah.
All of that. Do you know what I'm saying?
That's
and still
point.
Seep through at every single point.
Yeah. And it was still so effortless, you know, for her. Like, her performance, like Carla was telling me, basically, she was like, she always just looks like she's just kind of throwing it out there.
Yeah.
You know, like, there wasn't a lot of, even her, like, her music was emotive.
Yeah.
She was relatively, like, calm.
Mm-hmm. It was there in what she had created. It was there. All the beats were there.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to come back. I think we should come back to the music. So,
yes, I do want to come back to music.
Protest music, man. And you touched on this before. You know, like, nobody, no, there's no contemporary in terms for the content and the
quality
and consistency.
Yeah.
Like, there is no, she didn't have a contemporary.
Mm-mm. No, no, not then, no.
And there is not one now.
No. It's even when we talk about back then, they were like they mentioned in the New York article, like, she started after Sammy Davis Jr. and Harry Belafonte. Fine, 10 black people. Get them together. Ask them to name 10 songs from either of them.
Yeah.
And I think that they're both obviously supremely talented.
Clearly.
But, like, name 10 Harry Belafonte songs. Please name 10 Sammy Davis Jr. songs. Name, and then name 10 of their protest songs.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like, Nina is untouched.
Yeah. And, like, you can rattle them off. And each of them, it's amazing how different and masterful each of them are in terms of the different types of messages that they're communicating.
Yeah.
You know, like, Four Women is detailing, obviously, the different types of the different types of abuse and the ways in which women, you know, have been subjugated to that abuse over time. You can talk about Mississippi Goddamn, which is experiencing an immense amount of, like, frustration and clear disgust, which is kind of like, you know, and I always fuck with a certain level of, like, open disgust.
Yeah, I'm aware.
Yeah. That shit gives me high. But But yeah, she was just pissed off at like the way this is. Like, goddamn, you know, like this is what I'm subjugated to. This country is built on lies.
Yeah.
You know, and you have her, even her renditions of, you know, like Strange Fruit, like.
Yeah.
Like being peppered with such clear, like uncomfortable emotion, like the pitch, mm-hmm. like how she approaches all of her keys. Like everyone was different. And like the depth of all those things in its totality is mm-hmm. amazingly impressive and almost overwhelming to a degree. You can dive deep into the protest songs.
Yes, exactly. Only the protest songs.
Yeah.
Even like, what is that? Ain't Got No... I yeah. Got Life or whatever, the, yeah. which is from Hair, mm-hmm. which is like, you know, sung by a bunch of white people in this musical or whatever. And like, I'm familiar with that version. I'm familiar with that song. But then also like hers is like they say, even in the New York article, which is totally true, that in her hands, that song took a completely different.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It took on a completely different meaning. It took on new life. It meant something completely different than its original intent. Just because it was her singing it. Like, it's rare to see somebody who's, like, one of my favorite, two of my favorite singers are people who have just supreme interpretation skills. So you have Aretha and you have Sarah Vaughan. Mm-hmm. They can take yeah. anybody else's piece of music, pick it up, and then in their hands it's just... Yeah.
It's
yeah. I mean, exactly. And, but, you know, you don't necessarily know of Aretha to really be sitting down... all the time. You know what I'm saying? Like, necessarily writing all her own
composing.
Shit. Composing, exactly. And, you know, there are people who are great at composing who couldn't interpret anybody else. You know, they can only do their own shit. But Nina, even if you're just looking at protest songs, it's like the way that she imbues the shit that is, you know, the shit that's hers is awesome. But the way that she imbues the shit that isn't hers with her particular flair, just like it almost like creates like her. It's like she can have a library unto herself.
Yeah.
It makes it seem like it's all her own. You know what I mean? It's like it could be a genre unto itself, just Nina Simone protest music.
And like it's also amazing to see someone, you know, I mean, obviously we know what this did to her, but to see someone commit themselves to this degree to this type of sustained action,
mm-hmm.
you know, like it was a sustained action to continuously produce this type of music
yeah.
in spite of what it did to her career, her body,
mm-hmm.
her family,
mm-hmm.
you know, the people around her
yep.
even. That's, you know, that is impressive is not the right word. It's humbling.
Yeah.
It's humbling to see someone take that charge and give up everything to, mm-hmm. you know, to continue it and not stop. But then have a, like, towards the end of her career, she clearly had a complicated relationship with it because of what it did to her.
Yeah.
But she couldn't release it. She still felt it was valuable.
Yeah.
It was clearly worth it for her. Well, sometimes she struggled. Sometimes she struggled, but... Yeah, like that's just it's very humbling to see someone do that. Like I think she said she was like, all I can do is expose the sickness.
Yeah.
Woo.
My eyebrows are raised.
That's a mandate.
Well, it's like when we saw Selma, you know, and
yeah.
and obviously Nina Simone is a genius the same way that Martin Luther King was. You know, he possessed something that I can't put it into words, but you know it's fucking rare,
yeah.
right? But like, even so, at the end of the day, especially like when you take in the whole of the documentary, she was a regular person. Do you know what I'm saying? And to obviously, like, she possessed, you know, not just extraordinary talent, but like we've said over and over again throughout this episode, genius level talent. She still was somebody who was just as, you know, trying to fumble with life shit the same way the rest of us are. And she didn't let that stop her. Even though she possessed so much doubt and insecurity, she didn't let that stop her from doing what she needed to do and from attempting greatness in so many different ways across the board.
Yeah.
And that part, I was able to step away with and be like, you know, you don't have to just be... You know, you don't have to be. It's that reminder that you need, that like you don't have to be perfect to be present. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You just kind of have to. You can show up as you are and give what it is that you have and what it is that you can do it at the very best level that you can possibly do it, and like that can be enough. That can be more than enough.
Yeah, I mean, and the other thing that I think about is and that's honestly kind of depressing in context. Like, looking back at her protest music, you know, looking back at, like, what she sacrificed to produce that mm-hmm. is, in terms of, like, the results of that sacrifice, there was a quick interview snippet she had with this other, like, I don't want to speak too ill of this woman, but do you remember that part where she was talking to this very, like, 80s looking, like 80s, early 90s looking black woman? She
yes.
was, you know,
she was
very
she
even
look.
Toned.
Yes.
And she was like, "So are you happy by the progress we've made?" And, like, this is a black woman now, mind you. And Nia Simone, she kind of, like, cut her eyes to her just ever so slightly. Uh-huh. Not enough to know that, like, yo, I'm about to go off on you.
Yeah.
But just, like, no. Like, she was like, basically, like,
bitch,
like,
asking me these questions.
What's changed? She was basically like, what, you know, what has really changed?
Mm-hmm.
She was like, I think she said something to the effect of, I'm still not free.
Yes. Yes.
And that was in the 80s. Mm. And where are we today?
Yeah.
Like, what's going on? Like, her music is just as impactful and relevant.
Yeah.
Today.
Yeah.
Like, that's, at one point they said something like, they're still shooting people. I had the line written down. I thought I had the line written down.
Uh-huh.
But, like, it's the exact same thing. And, you know, I also think it was interesting her, the other thing that's extremely relevant is this, the relationship between, like, nonviolence and violence and, you
yeah.
know, and just
yeah,
like,
yeah, 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 yeah.
She was, you know, she was very adamant about, like, no, I'm not nonviolent. I also think that runs very counter to this idea that everything that happened in the civil rights movement
was some nonviolent
yeah.
Martin Luther King shit.
No. I mean, there was a very clear, like,
yeah. And even the existence of nonviolent movement was tactical
yeah.
because we needed to have both.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? In order
there needed to be a balance.
There needed to be a balance.
Yeah. You needed, you know, Stokely to make them negotiate with Martin.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So, but yeah, like, that's just overall, it's like, it's really depressing how relevant her music still is. I wish we could listen to it with a bit more distance.
Yeah. Yeah. But I don't even know when. You know what I mean? I don't know when that
yeah.
day is coming.
And, it, you know, it speaks to her clear, like, lack of hope or acceptance. You know, she just
yeah.
was like, this is kind of what it is. I'm still, you know, I'm still struggling to a degree. I'm still not free.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, she's pushing through. And I think that's how a lot of people, actually, you know what this makes, I think that's how a lot of people feel. But you know what this makes me think of?
What?
A lot of the criticism of Between Me and the World. You know, people saying that, like, there was no
oh,
real hope.
Yeah.
And there was another thing.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people, like, actually in Post Bougie, they
uh-huh.
were talking about that NPR episode about integration of schools.
Oh, my God. By Nicole Hannah-Jones?
Yeah.
Yeah, she's great. Yeah, that was good.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. And, you know, basically, they were talking about this notion of, like, there's all, like, people are always trying to push us to have, like, to profess our hope
yeah.
for this change. And as if they're surprised that we have little.
Well, that's the thing that blows my mind is that you would, okay, so Ta-Nehisi Coates, my man been on the race beat.
For a long time.
for a long time, right? Not only has he been on the race beat, black man married to a black woman living in this black ass city.
Yeah.
Well, to some degree, urban area, right? And he's got a black son who's in his teens, right? And he's not just been on the beat for a long time, so he's fatigued, but he's also been, he's a natural born researcher.
Yeah.
He probably would say different, but the type of curiosity that man possesses, it's like, yeah, it can be fed, but you also have to be born with it, right?
Yeah.
And so he's a natural born researcher, and he has been, he's looked critically at American history since at the very least 1860, right?
Yeah.
Up through the present. So, like, he has not just, you know, an amazing mind, but he has the support of this gigantic institution in the Atlantic,
yeah.
which allows you access to any document, you know what I'm saying, to any record whatsoever. So he has the mind, he has the resources, he has the backing. He also has this gigantic platform to be able to have dialogue. He's smart enough to have dialogue with people who may have more specific areas of knowledge than he does, right?
Yeah.
So he's got all of these things working in his favor to be able to give him this, you know, amazingly nuanced look at what race is like in America in 2015.
At the true dynamics of our country.
Exactly. And so he knows all the shit. And at the end, and so not only it pisses me off because not only do you, like just at the most base level, you think he done all this research and like you, and then you expect him to look at all those facts and then have hope. But also, he's produced this work of greatness, and you expect him to assuage your discomfort by having hope and professing that he still has it. It's like, so he's done this great work. It's almost like a Kanye level thing, right?
Yeah.
Where it's like I've done this work to show you what you are, right? Yeah. I've done this great work, and then you don't want me to, but you want me to contradict that by saying that, like, for any fucking reason, that I still have hope.
Yeah.
That's so fucked up.
It's basically like you want me to support your own hope and wish that you can change.
Yes. Well, you know what, though? When you talk about assuaging people's fears, and this is like another left turn, that also has to do with Nina, but also has to do with, this is a conversation I had with Lolo. I'm going to give Lolo some credit because Lolo actually was like bouncing this to me like, y'all should talk about this on the show. But this is, and like, you know, you should talk to him about it in general. But there's this jazz guy who's out, Kamasi Washington. Mm-hmm. And I don't know too much specifically about that thread of the story, but he's, I watched his live at NPR, like live at Washington or whatever the fuck, like Jazz Night in America or whatever. Yeah. It's like it's a 2-hour thing. He has this awesome album. Everybody's fucking on it. You see like fucking 25 people. It's like a Wu-Tang concert, right? It's like 25 people on the stage.
Yeah.
And like it starts off with cacophony and then it just goes into 2 hours of just like, it almost feels like a jam, but you know that the shit is so well orchestrated. Yeah. And he's a big guy. He's sizable and he's proud, right? And he's released this amazing contemporary jazz album. He's touring out like throughout America now and throughout the rest of the world in the fall. And people, I think, in the jazz world seem to be like bristling at the way that he's handling his success. And people have responded to kind of like Ta-Nehisi in the same way. Like, I've created this work of greatness. And like that is telling you the truth about yourself, and the truth is that I have no reason to be hopeful. But you still want me to be hopeful to make you feel comfortable. And then also with Serena.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Where Serena right now is this woman who people don't want. She's a black woman. People don't want her to, like, the people are struggling so much again with, she should be America's sweetheart, like Lauryn Hill, or like Anita Simone, you know what I'm saying? This or like a Beyonce or whoever should be, you know, one of America's most treasured talents, whether it's, you know, talent of, you know, natural genius or natural aptitude or sheer force of fucking greatness.
Will
exactly. Right. But people are struggling with giving that mantle over to this person because of what, you know, what does that say? Because what does that say about if black is great? What does that say about me?
Yeah.
And, you know, or if America is terrible, what does that say about me? If you can be proud, if you can be genius level, or if you can be great, but you can also be black and you can also be proud, what does that say about me? And it's like Nina did this, you know what I'm saying? Nina is the same thing. It's like she's so, when she was just like in Carnegie Hall playing this classical music, everybody was like, oh, we love Nina, it's great. But like when she was like still at that level of greatness, her talent is growing still, right? Yeah. And her genius is growing still. We're not growing, but her ability to translate it is growing. And additionally, she's exposing the sickness. She's telling the truth about us, right?
Yeah.
And like she's doing that, but like you still can't say that she's not, you still can't say that she's great because of what that says about you.
Yeah.
It's like, that's like the classic of, that's like the classic black American. It's like Muhammad Ali. It's like name any black motherfucker who's the best at what the fuck they do.
And that's the situation that they end up in.
Yeah.
You know? And you know, I don't even think it's a lot more needs to be said. to be sure, you know, like honestly, we could talk about this. We can go back and forth, and it's, you know, you can connect it to, like you said, to every narrative of our success and genius, you know. But that's just what it is. I think you know, all I can do is expose the sickness.
Yeah,
that's all I got.
That's all I got. So,
thank you for listening for Color Nerds this week.
Thank you for listening for Color Nerds.
You know, we'll obviously be back in 2 weeks. Follow us on Twitter, follow us on, or like us on Facebook.
you remember that? We on social media. We out here for Color Nerds.
Yeah,
everywhere.
Subscribe and review.
Yeah, subscribe, rate, review. Tell everybody that you know, and you know, just like keep doing you. Don't let the man tell you that you can't be great, and tell them about theyself.
And
self care. Yeah.
All right, y'all.
All right, we're out. There's more than one recording of Nina Simone singing Mississippi Goddamn. There's one There's two in particular that I like, one in 1964 and one in 1968. The song came out in 1964. I think she's performing it at Carnegie Hall. And she has such pep and such energy. But she's performing with such pep and such energy because it's clever. And she's in 1964 and she doesn't know that 65, 66, 67, and 68 are coming, right? You can hear a different version of 1968. I don't know where she recorded it, but she also had an audience. I remember realizing right around August when I was keeping up with Ferguson that she was fatigued, and you could hear it in her voice. And it was right after Martin Luther King died. She said, "The king is dead. The king of love is dead." It just hits you because, you know, we grew up going to school learning about Martin Luther King and that he died. You know what I mean? And he's... it's one of the few they give us. And my whole life, he's been dead. Your whole life, he's been dead. But this is somebody that she knew. You know what I'm saying? And this is somebody who was in the middle of something that was happening. And on some level, she probably knew that he was going to have to go away. But, like, she didn't think it was going to happen that way. And she didn't think it was going to happen then. Do you know what I'm saying? That was her friend. And so to kind of hear her with four more years of this shit on her, four more years, and how bedraggled she sounds. I used to wonder what it took to get to that point. And now I guess I feel like I don't have to wonder anymore.
You love, and of course a couple of years ago four little girls were killed in Alabama, and at that time we got the inspiration to do this song. But Dr. King's murder has left me so numb, I don't know where I'm at, really. And of course you heard this song that was composed by Gene Taylor, especially for today. But I hope that between now and the end of the year, it'll all be together enough that we will have songs that go down in history for these wonderful, brave people who are no longer with us. Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Alabama's got me so upset. Lurleen Wallace has made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Can't you see it? I know you can feel it. It's all in the air. I can't stand the pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama has got me so upset, and Memphis has made me lose my rest. Everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Hound dogs on my trail, little school children sitting in jail. Black cat crossed my path, I think every day's gonna be my last. Lord have mercy on this land of mine. We all gonna get it in due time. Cause I don't belong here, I don't belong there. I've even stopped believing in prayer. Just about due. I've been there, so I know. You keep on saying go slow. Well, that's just the trouble. Washing the windows. Picking the cotton. Nothing but rotten. Too damn lazy. Thinking's crazy. Where am I going? What am I doing? I don't know. I don't know. Just try to do my very best. It's stand up, be counted with all the rest, 'cause everybody knows about Mississippi. Goddamn! Now you heard him. He's one of you. If you have been moved at all, and you know my songs at all, for God's sakes, join me. Don't sit back there. The time is too late now. Good God. You know, the king is dead. The king of love is dead. I ain't about to be nonviolent, honey. Oh, no. Picket lines, school boycotts. They try to say it's a communist plot. But all I want is equality for my sister, my brother, my people, and me. And I loved him because he believed it. He lived by it. But you lied to me all the years. You told me to wash and clean my ears and talk real fine just like a lady, and you stopped calling my mama Aunt Sadie. Hear me now. But my country is full of lies. We all gonna die and die like flies. I don't trust nobody anymore. Keep on saying, go slow. That's just the trouble.
No.
Desegregation.
No.
Mass participation.
No.
Unification.
No.
Do things gradually.
No.
But bring more. Tragedy. Why don't you see it? Why don't you feel it? I don't know. I don't know. You don't have to live next to me. Just give me my equality. 'Cause everybody knows about Mississippi. Everybody.